Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and more Monday Morning Politics now, mostly de Blasio transition politics with Era Lewis from New York One and Eleanor Tatum, editor and publisher of the Amsterdam News. Errol hosts Road to City Hall weeknights on New York One. Hi, Errol. Hi, Eleanor.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. But before we go local, here's that Gingrich story I mentioned earlier. When Nelson Mandela died last week, Gingrich posted a statement calling him one of the greatest leaders of our lifetime. But as CNN reports, the right-wing response was overwhelmingly reproachful. Quote, "Such an amazing rewrite of history since 1962 and 1990, Newt. I thought you, of all people, a historian, would be true to who this guy really was," on Gingrich's Facebook page. Another one, "This clenched fist, murdering guerrilla warrior," G-O-R-I-L-L-A, by the way, "does not deserve respect from informed Americans," posted another person. And on State of the Union yesterday, CNN Sunday morning talk show, Gingrich expressed his surprise and talked back to some of these people. This is almost a two-minute clip with Candy Crowley, host of CNN State of the Union, but it's fascinating to hear this from Newt Gingrich.
I was very surprised by it, and Calista had posted my statement on her Facebook page and was amazed at some of the intensity, some of whom came back three, four, and five times, repeating how strong, how angry they were. Now, the two points I make to people about Mandela personally are, first of all, this very long, deep commitment to freedom, which I think most of us could identify with. And second, that after 27 years in prison, he doesn't come out bitter. He doesn't come out angry. He comes out as an extraordinarily wise man who actually invites his prison guard to sit in the front row at his inauguration as president.
Ted Cruz also put out a very complimentary statement in saluting Nelson Mandela and got the same kind of pushback. Do you think that these are fellow conservatives? Do you have any? Who do you think these folks are?
Look, I think there are some people who bought a rationale that defined everybody who was in any way in rebellion against the established system in the Third World as anti-American, which I in fact don't think they were. I think that we were the symbol of what they wanted. We were the kind of country they wanted to become. But I do think there are people who have sustained this kind of mythology. And there's no question that in the 50s, Mandela moved from a nonviolent model towards being allied with the communists. And my point to conservatives is there weren't any conservative allies. I mean, Churchill allied with Stalin during World War II. And I think in a similar tradition, Mandela was desperate by that stage. He saw the scale of the oppression. And the only allies that were available, frankly, were on the hard left.
Newt Gingrich on CNN yesterday on State of the Union with Candy Crowley, surprised by right-wing vitriolic language and racism with respect to Nelson Mandela. And Errol Lewis, to state the obvious, here is a guy who used vitriol and has a history of using racially coded language, surprised by the very sentiment that he taps into, if not encourages. Are you surprised by this whole dynamic around Newt Gingrich over the last few days?
Well, I'm a little bit skeptical of his surprise. I mean, he cannot credibly claim to be, dumbfounded at the depth of what was, at its root, if nothing else, is anti-communist sentiment. I mean, he wrote that. I mean, that's his politics too. I'm actually grateful for this conversation in a way, Brian, because as somebody who was a campus anti-apartheid protester, as Nelson Mandela now belongs to the ages, slips into the history books, makes it onto the postage stamps, and so forth. What I remember from 30 years ago was that it was considered somewhat controversial to disrupt campus operations and to complain and write articles and all of the stuff that we did on behalf of Nelson Mandela and the anti-apartheid movement. It was considered controversial. It was not something that everybody just took to. Maybe the historian Newt Gingrich forgot that, but I certainly didn't. And maybe I guess he needed a reminder. I mean, it so happens that because he was in prison for 27 years, Nelson Mandela didn't put out a lot of statements. It was illegal to print anything from him. And so, you know, a lot of his mistakes and his alliances and his controversial beliefs, you know, just kind of passed by. And so he pops out of prison and he's this global hero. But the reality is, politics is hard. You don't get to pick your allies all the time. And there are a lot of people who don't like you. I mean, and, you know, that's not that big of a surprise, is it?
And Eleanor, the end of his statement was pretty amazing from a conservative historian's lips. My point to conservatives is there weren't any conservative allies. This is against apartheid. He saw the scale of oppression, and the only allies that were available, frankly, were on the hard left. That's Newt Gingrich's take on the history of the 1980s, not the 1850s.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's his take on history. But, you know, what I see from the comments that we were getting from these, quote-unquote, at some point, Gingrich supporters, talking about Nelson Mandela in that way, is the true hatred that there is for anything that is not like them. And it doesn't matter if it's here in America or abroad, because Nelson Mandela exemplified so much. And Newt Gingrich did the right thing by saying what he said about Nelson Mandela. And the fact that the right has to attack it, even in death, is something that I find just really abhorrent.
And I guess we shouldn't make too much of it. I'm sure Mandela would poll at some gargantuan number as a positive and a hero in the United States today. And we know 20 high-velocity people control the Internet and look like a force. But still, it's an eye-opener.
That's a good point. But, I mean, Gingrich's point is also very well taken. I mean, even after he got out of prison, Nelson Mandela had a delicate balancing act, not just with the communists, who he sort of distanced himself from gently, but people like Gaddafi, people like Yasser Arafat, people like Castro, who were indeed the only people who were speaking on his behalf, or the sorts of people who were speaking on his behalf during 27 long years in prison. And he would make no bones about it. He's like, look, when our struggle was like on the ropes and I was behind bars, these are the people who supported me. Yeah. And, you know, end of discussion.
And they weren't the only people, though. It's an interesting footnote to the history of the Reagan administration, when Gingrich was generally known as a young flame-throwing backbencher in the House from Georgia, you know, a decade before he became Speaker, that Gingrich supported sanctions against South Africa when Reagan vetoed a sanctions bill. And as Cokie Roberts reminded us on Morning Edition today, a Republican majority Senate overturned Reagan's veto of the sanctions 78-21. To take a moral stand against apartheid. So maybe that would be...
Does that mean that they were a much more progressive right than we have now?
Probably so, at least in that respect. All right, closer to home. Bill Bratton and Bill de Blasio made their first joint appearance Saturday after the news conference at which Bratton was announced, and it was a meeting of Reverend Al Sharpton's National Action Network in Harlem. Here is Reverend Sharpton making the introduction.
I bring you Commissioner... Designee Bill Bratton.
And here is de Blasio speaking to the audience and referencing Mandela, by the way.
Anyone who tries to tell you that you can't have safety and constitutional rights at the same time, that you can't have a strong society and a fair society at the same time, I would remind them of the example of Nelson Mandela.
You cannot mourn Mandela and then profile his grandchildren.
So Sharpton after de Blasio, and here is Bratton to the audience also invoking Mandela.
I like being a cop because I know what cops can do when we get it right. And my promise to you is we will get it right in this city. And our commitment to you is that your police force in your city will be respectful. It will practice what Mandela preached. Freedom for all. Respect for all. Compassion for all.
Not great sound quality, but Bill Bratton saying your police force will be respectful and practice what Mandela preached. So Eleanor Tatum, editor-publisher of the Amsterdam News, talk to me about the Sharpton factor in New York politics. He's a national host on MSNBC, certainly has a national profile for a long time already. Does he still matter to local politics?
Absolutely. I mean, his base is New York, and he's still effective in New York, and he's still vocal in New York. I mean, if he just went to the national stage and forgot about New York City, it would be a different story. But he's still at his Saturday rallies. You know, people are still coming to those Saturday rallies that are running for office, that have now attained office, that are going to be in office, because they need the community support, and Sharpton helps deliver that.
And Errol Lewis from New York One, Mayor Giuliani consistently refused to meet with Sharpton during Giuliani's 8 years as mayor. And I'm sure you remember that Mayor Bloomberg did right away after being elected as one of his first acts to show that he was going to be different from Rudy. And here we are again, 12 years later, with Sharpton having enough clout that the first public appearance that de Blasio and Bratton make after the announcement is with Sharpton in the National Action Network.
Well, that's right. I mean, first of all, there's a little bit of unfinished business there. I mean, during those years when Giuliani very publicly snubbed black leadership, and it wasn't just Sharpton. I mean, he wouldn't meet with, you know, Carl McCall or anybody else. Mm.
That radical Carl McCall working on Wall Street.
That radical Carl McCall. But it included the years that Bratton was the commissioner. So they kind of needed to patch that up a little bit. And that handshake photo, which you tweeted out earlier, is, you know, sort of proof of that. I think also, look, de Blasio, like many other people, and Bloomberg is one of them, has decided that the political fortune does not lie in trying to exclude or read Al Sharpton out of New York or mainstream American politics. And that is a pretty sound bet at this point. You know, I mean, folks forget, but as you know, Brian, he does 3 hours of radio every day, and it's broadcast right here in New York City. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes on a little bit under the radar, but he is part of New York politics. I mean, there's just no getting around that. And even if you don't like him, you have to at least go by and shake his hand and acknowledge that he's there.
So, Eleanor, City Councilman Jumaane Williams from Brooklyn, one of the leading critics of Stop and Frisk and leaders of the City Council movement to pass those couple of bills this summer that Bratton didn't like, was publicly on the record not liking an inspector general for the police department or this bill making it easier to sue for racial profiling. Jumaane Williams said Bratton's record here in the past was mixed, partly because of the database system known as Comstat that Bratton and Giuliani and Jack Maple brought in back in 1994-95, and that the database system known as Comstat encourages a quota system because it is so numbers-based. But if anything, I think the whole world is more database today than it was when Bratton was police commissioner back then. And I think crime is measured even more in numbers, and police productivity is measured more in numbers. So are Jumaane Williams and Bratton on a collision course?
Well, I think it's all a wait and see, but I think it's very likely. And I mean, if we, you know, there was a Cranes piece that was done a few years back, and Cranes asked Bratton, if crime started dropping under the Dinkins administration, how come Mr. Giuliani gets the credit? And Bratton came back and said the crime rate would have not have dropped as dramatically without the Giuliani approach. Dinkins made the hires but didn't effectively use the office. They weren't focused on crime but on his community relations. So if that's how Bratton felt 3 years ago, what's that going to mean for this administration?
Yeah.
So I question it myself. I mean, he doesn't think the community relations approach works. Well, that leaves us with Stop and Frisk. Now, that's not what de Blasio wants. So what are we going to have?
Then again, don't we see Bratton's record in Los Angeles, Eleanor, as being one of successfully improving both community relations and crime reduction?
We do. And my hope, at least, is that because it's under a different mayor, we'll see a different result here in New York. But, you know, he's got a history here in New York, and he's going to have to change that legacy.
Is this just Bratton being able to play either side of this message, Errol Lewis, and then coming in and doing what he does? But he's good at public relations, both on the community relations side and on the crime reduction side, and maybe actually good at improving both when he's in office.
He's certainly good when it comes to what you could call public relations, but there's a part of this conversation that never really got much in-depth attention in New York because there were so many legal and political and electoral fights around Stop and Frisk. But what Bratton has said consistently, and he's been saying this for years, is that the way that you actually conduct the stop face-to-face matters a great deal, and that the problem in New York is not so much that there are stops, but that the stops are not being done, in his opinion, properly, that the cops are not experienced enough, they're not being properly supervised, they're not doing what they're supposed to do in the course of the stop, and that that is what generated much of the resentment. And frankly, the numbers suggest that he may have a point there, because in Los Angeles, apparently in his last year, he did something like 850,000 stops.
Wow.
If you adjust for population, it's like over a million in New York, and it didn't generate the kind of intense political pushback that we saw here in New York. So we'll see if
and Jumaane Williams said the other day, a million constitutional stops is fine if they're constitutional stops. He says, I'm not counting. I'm seeing if they're constitutional.
Right. I also believe about 30% of those ended up in some sort of action versus just stopping people in not having anything happen to them.
Yes, I saw that. No, that is so. That's really important. Because a third of your stops wind up with some kind of violation or arrest, compared to what was it, 9% here in New York?
I think that's giving them a little bit too much credit. I think it's less than that.
So that means the quality of the stops were different. One other thing before you both go, De Blasio needs the state legislature for his universal pre-K funding. And I saw a Capital New York story today that the Republican leader of the state Senate, Dean Scalos, who would be the biggest stumbling block, presumably, appealed to Congress for pre-K funding. And I find that so interesting. I thought Scalos would tend to say no to de Blasio's tax hike on the wealthiest city residents. But here he is making the case to Washington, Errol, for the centrality of pre-K as an issue. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, what I see happening is that Albany may give de Blasio what he wants. On the other hand, it might be a case of, you know, be careful what you wish for, because I could see any number of players in Albany, including the governor most especially, but also the Senate Majority Leader, as basically taking credit for it, saying, you know, we did this, and we did this. Could mean they came up with the money from somewhere else in the state budget, which is very possible, or that they allowed New York City to tax itself, or, as in this case, that they found some pocket of money somewhere in Washington to pay for it. So, he may be well on his way to getting what it is he wants, but he may have to share credit for that with a lot of other people.
Eleanor, last word on this?
Well, I think it's a lot of other people that are going to try to take all the credit for it, especially if they can get the federal funding or find it somewhere else and still say, we didn't have to tax the rich and we'll be able to keep the rich in New York.
Eleanor Tatum, editor and publisher of the Amsterdam News. Errol Lewis, host of Road to City Hall, 7 and 10 weeknights on New York One. Thank you both very much for talking some Monday morning politics with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.